here today again with another A Lens a Day Conversations About Information Architecture. And today I get to talk to the insightful Margot Bloomstein. Margot, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. I am excited to be talking with you.
When we set this up, you were very clear with me that you don't call yourself an information architect, which is cool. Like about half the people that I've interviewed don't call themselves information architecture. But what I've always appreciated about your work is that you bring kind of a sensibility about language, of course, a sensibility about kind of user-centered design into the work that you do. Can you talk to me a little bit about that process when you're thinking about content, maybe not the specific words on the page, but when you're thinking about content strategy in terms of the structures that you need to build around it, what does that process look like? And what I'm particularly interested in are, what are the parts that are hardest to get people, your stakeholders, your clients, your other design team members to come along with you? What are the parts where you feel like you need to work hardest to bring people along for the ride?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. And it's funny that you say you notice my focus on kind of users or user experience design, because I almost feel like my process starts with not first thinking of the users, which I know is kind of like verboten in these parts. But I guess I think first about the needs of my client. I start by thinking about their business goals, and I want them to think hard about their business goals. Like, why are they bringing together, if it's an agency of which I'm a part or a team that I'm augmenting, or even if they've brought me in because they're saying, we need, you know, this in our year of Beyonce in 2021, if they're able to say, we need to focus on content strategy and not just the old words of like, we're going through a rebranding, or we think we want to look different, so maybe we need to sound different too. But when they say, you know, we need to focus on content strategy and they've brought me in, my first question to them is always, well, why? What are you trying to accomplish? What are your communication goals? And sometimes they don't know. Sometimes it's that they don't necessarily have different communication goals, but they see that they're losing a lot of people. Turnover has been really high, maybe within customer service or within marketing or among the people that used to always contribute to their blog or to different campaigns. And they say, well, we have an HR problem. We're just not connecting with our internal audience very well. Or maybe they say that they see how competitors are kind of owning thought leadership within their industry, and they're doing a really good job talking about their technology or really putting a stake in the ground around social issues that matter to their shared target audience. So I try to get them to figure out, what are their communication goals before we embark on creating this new website or reconfiguring their CMS or launching some new campaign or type of print collateral. Why? What are we trying to communicate? And I think going through that process, that helps them figure out who they are, how they are, how they are different, what they're saying is different, why they need to communicate something different or just communicate differently, maybe with more of an eye to how that communication will be sustainable for both their target audience as well as for the folks internally that are contributing to it. And we go through that kind of process, I think, of first helping them know themselves. It's that sort of nathi sotum, know thyself moment. And then I feel like I'm best positioned to partner with the user research team or to help them look at their existing analytics and user research and knowledge of their customers and their different target audiences to help them figure out how do we bridge that distance then between who they are, what they want to communicate, what they need to offer, and then what their audience needs. How do we kind of forge that sort of rhetorical arena there in the middle where both parties' needs are being met in a consistent, cohesive, sustainable way that is also appropriate to their brand?
Nice. I would imagine you talked a lot about communication goals, and I would imagine that that, you know, when you walk into a client meeting or a kickoff for the first time, those are not the things at the top of their minds, right? They may be sort of looking at the world from an even higher level, higher altitude, like, you know, this, our goals are more sales, or our goals are whatever they are. They're more business oriented than, say, communication oriented, or they're zoomed way in where they're like, well, this web page is broken, or, and they're not thinking sort of at the communication goal level. That's not something that I think comes naturally to a lot of the folks that we get to interact with as stakeholders and clients. What are some of your favorite tools or techniques or approaches for helping people zero in on what those goals might be?
So when I talk with them about communication goals, I don't usually use that kind of term, because you're right. For some people, even folks that work in the marketing department, even folks that maybe work in visual design and branding, they're not really comfortable with using those terms, because maybe they have before, only to be burnt, because everybody says, well, we want to be more modern or more innovative. And then you ask, well, tactically, how does that change what you do? How will that change your choice of content types? Or how does that affect the editorial style and tone? Or how does that determine maybe the hierarchy in your visual branding? And they sit back and they say, well, I don't know. I mean, we've always wanted to be more modern. Who doesn't want to be more modern? It's kind of just same stuff, different day. And I think it's because we're so comfortable flinging around a lot of those terms that we don't necessarily take the time to interrogate them and say, well, what do we mean by that? You know, are we all on the same page about what it means to be modern or innovative or even empathetic or transparent? We say we want to be transparent and authentic and accountable, but what does that actually mean, and how will that affect what we do on a day-to-day basis and the choices that we make on a day-to-day basis in content and design, as well as in HR and in PR? So when I talk with them about communication goals, I start by asking, well, who are you versus who are you not? What are the qualities that better describe maybe a competitor, or that just you'd never want to have associated with your brand? And then who would you like to be in the hearts and minds of your target audience? Because all efforts around content strategy, and I would say all efforts around design and information architecture, are aspirational. They call us in, we do this work because whatever they've got going on now isn't working for them anymore. It isn't enough. So we're trying to make something better, and that is aspirational. And the tool that I use to help them kind of suss out those communication goals and to facilitate the conversation so that I can then create a message architecture for them is BrandSort. And it's there. and it is a process and a deck of about 90 cards listing out attributes that I've heard from brands across pretty much every industry over the past 20 years that they use to describe themselves, who they are, who they're not, who they'd like to be. And it's funny, like all these organizations think they're so special and different. We all use the same words though. What is special and different about our organizations is the priority that we put on those terms, as well as how we define them. Because in some places, modern is a 1950s furniture aesthetic and hard and unforgiving. In other places, modern feels not cutting edge enough, and cutting edge doesn't feel bleeding edge enough. So there's all that nuance around the terms. And I use that process, the BrandSort process, to help them discuss what those terms mean. Because language is a common interface for most people in our broader industry. Even people that prefer to work visually, we still often use words to describe our process and our goals. So if we can get to a place where we're using a constrained vocabulary and then defining that vocabulary as we go, so that we're all in the practice of saying, I really think we need to be more innovative. And by innovative, this is what I mean. or we need to project a greater sense of tradition. This is what tradition means here. When we can use words to further unpack our vocabulary, words to further unpack our words, that's when we establish that even playing field and common purpose among our different disciplines.
That was awesome. I'd forgotten that you have a card deck. We should just do a podcast just about all the different UX related card decks out there.
It's Steven Anderson on talking about that too, because that's who I turned to when I was first developing it. I was like, print products, let's talk.
I love that. And I love that you've got this sort of tactile tool that you can use, because I really feel like, yes, words are the sort of bread and butter of the work, the key ingredients of the work that we do. And one of the best ways to get people thinking deeply about those words is to make them physical, in a sense, right? To give them something, even if it's just a card, like being able to manipulate and handle it, I think helps us internalize that. And when we can internalize the word, we can start to really think about the things that you're talking about, like, what do we mean by this word? I was literally on a client meeting yesterday where we kept using this phrase to describe what we were going to do. And at some point, someone on my team was like, I need to know what we mean by these words, because we're talking about them like we all have the same understanding of what we're going to do in this part of the project. But I don't want to get anyone's expectations confused, or I don't want to miss what people are expecting because we haven't defined our terms. Can you maybe tell us a story about a time where the light bulb went off for some of your stakeholders, where you had this sort of, you witnessed an epiphany moment where through defining terms or exploring words, you or your stakeholders or your clients were able to kind of put things together in a new way?
Sure. Yeah. Well, let me give you two, actually. There was an organization that I worked with several years ago, and gosh, I can't remember the brand, but I remember what I learned from them. I think they were an organization in the financial services space, and they were talking about bringing a new product to market that would help investors kind of have an edge on the marketplace, maybe a little bit more insight into managing their portfolios. And their target audience was smart. They didn't need a lot of hand-holding. They thought of themselves as smart. They were already pretty confident. And with this tool, they also wanted to kind of underscore that as a financial services brand, they were also just as cutting edge and smart and aggressive as their investors. And one of the terms that I have in BrandSort is savvy. And as you said, you know, the value of a deck like that is that it makes these concepts a little bit more physical. Like you're physically picking up a card and holding it in your hand and maybe saying, savvy? Are we savvy or are we smart? What term am I going to put over in this group? What term am I going to put here? What term am I going to say is more important than the other one? So you're making physical, you're making choices and then having a physical reaction, moving them around and sorting them around, that really internalizes that process. You're literally putting muscle into it. And to see some of my stakeholders pick up the term savvy, which I'm thinking like, oh, that seems perfect for what you're describing, and sort of look at it and grimace, again, this physical reaction, it gave me pause. And I kind of was noting down like, what the hell was that? And as they're going through the initial steps of the process, that's what I'm doing. I'm noting down like, what are their reactions? Where are they leaning in? And where are they kind of pulling back? Or when somebody says something, where's everyone else kind of leaning and smirking, and how are they reacting? So after they put down savvy, a few minutes later, when it was my turn to kind of chime in, I said, what happened there? What was that about? Because I noticed you picked it up and you kind of grimaced and then put it back down. And one of the stakeholders said, well, we would never want to be known as savvy. That's a little too cutthroat. also that better describes our competition. We never want to have that associated with our brand. And I was like, oh, okay. And then I started tossing out some of the other terms that I think of as synonymous with savvy. And I was like, well, what about like assertive and empowered and acting on knowledge you already have? And they're like, yes, all of those things. There are all of those things. Turned out they had this aversion just to that particular term. And as I later learned, it was something that they had previously used in their marketing years prior, had gotten this negative connotation. And one of their competitors had a product that was using that term in some of their marketing copy now. And they were like, no, not us. So going through that kind of process does illuminate maybe a bit about the corporate history, a little bit about the marketing picadillos and pitfalls that I'm going to have to avoid, as well as a lot of the internal politics that kind of further clarify the process. But more recently, I think the term that has been kind of coming to bear a lot is vulnerability. And I think we hear about that more and more in corporate contexts. I think we have Brené Brown to thank for bringing it more into the language of personal interaction and professional interaction. And over the past couple of years, we've certainly seen how vulnerability is something that can undermine some businesses and strengthen some businesses. It's the secret sauce that makes some businesses more accessible to their audiences when they make known who they are and how they are, and when they make their values visible. In Trustworthy, it's one of the three pillars that I write about, where brands can embrace this idea of vulnerability. They can operationalize vulnerability to bring their audiences closer, bring them part of the design process, and turn some of their strongest, fiercest critics into ardent champions. But I think it is a term that in some contexts and in some industries, it still sounds weak. Maybe it's synonymous with weakness. And I think navigating connotation and denotation that we learn to do so well as designers, to really kind of find those nuances and work within them. That's especially important for terms like vulnerability when we're talking about how people react and how people interact and what is a source of strength and confidence among certain audiences and industries.
That's great. I feel like that's a good transition point to bring us to the lens that you picked out, which builds on those ideas. Can you tell us which lens we zeroed in on, and what does it mean to you?
Yeah, so we zeroed in on accountability, which I think as kind of a focal point within our work. I think you define it talking about the responsibility an organization takes with interacting with its users, maybe taking on their information, helping them engage in the overall experience. I think I look at it through some of those perspectives, through some of those lenses, but by and large, talking about control and the control of the experience, control of user experience, and sort of what we owe our users, what businesses owe their users, the ways in which designers are accountable to the businesses that we support and to our different audiences. I think those are all, those are some of the most important topics that that designers of all stripes can address right now. Because I think the idea of accountability, of saying, here is what we owe our users, can be an animating force for our work. The way I look at it, I think the biggest thing that we owe our users right now is empowerment, looking at how we empower them, how we give them more control over the process of learning and discovery, making choices from the very simple and mundane choices of interacting with basic web interfaces that they do so pretty thought without much thought, as well as when they're interacting in maybe bigger ticket purchases or weighing heavier kind of emotional decisions in online interfaces as well as offline. the more that we can empower them through our choices as designers and content strategists and IAs, the more we can empower them, the more we build their sense of confidence that they can make good decisions, that they know how to find information to make those decisions, that they can make good decisions and feel good about the decisions they make. And I think rebuilding that sense of confidence is the best antidote to several years of gaslighting in the political sphere that has carried over now to affect every industry in which we operate. I think it's the best way to kind of rebuild our society and kind of our accountability to each other. And it's also what's best for our economy. When we help people make good decisions about what they purchase, where they vote, how they vote, where they want to go out to eat, maybe where they just want to go next weekend, whether it's around the block, around their neighborhood, or go out and explore further afield. When we help them make good decisions and feel in control of those decisions, we're doing our part to rebuild their sense of confidence. And that's how we rebuild our trust in each other, in the brands that can best support us, in the organizations that can best support us, and in ourselves. And I think that is sorely what we need to do right now.
Right. I love how you're framing this in terms of helping the users reclaim control over their experiences. It's, I think, one of the things that makes our jobs hard, because on the one hand, we feel an obligation, and maybe obligation isn't even quite the right word, but we feel an obligation to make our users empowered, right? To empower them to make good, smart choices. At the same time, I worry sometimes in the design process that we become so preoccupied with user needs that the business tries to be everything to all people, right? It tries to dilute what it's about in its attempt to support user needs. And at the later stages of my career, I'm really coming to embrace this balance of empower the users, but do so in a way that aligns with what you can offer, right? Don't try and do too much. Don't try and stretch the scope of what your business can legitimately do, because in a sense, that is its own, that undermines trust as well. I don't know if you have examples or thoughts on that kind of balance from your own work.
I have a lot of thoughts on that balance. And I think this goes back to what we initially talked about with why I don't know that I do focus initially on the user's experience. And I think, over like the past 20 or so years in our industry, like certainly when I was coming up in our industry, that was around the time, at least in big agency consulting. Like I joined Sapien in 2000, so kind of like height of the dot-com boom and then bust. And that was around the time that in the early days of the web, where we were starting to move away from the idea of brochureware and just putting online what our clients wanted to say, but also starting to think of like, well, what do our users need to hear? And I think that was a very good and valid question to ask. And I think that's also though when we started to drag the pendulum then in the other direction to say user-centered design shouldn't be about what the business wants, needs to be just around what our users need. And I think that it was a good maturing kind of process for so many folks in our industry to live in that headspace for a while. I don't think it is where we needed to remain, but I think it's good that we spent time thinking that way, because it gives us the perspective to then say, well, if we only do what our users want, as you said, maybe it's not sustainable or right for all businesses. That's why I champion that what we do needs to not just be appropriate for our users, appropriate for the technology that we're using to support their experience, but also appropriate for those brands and what we are trying to communicate. Because I mean, the example that I always offer my students is that if every brand within an industry that shares the same target audience and offers about the same thing, if they all looked and sounded alike, it wouldn't serve them, and it definitely would not serve their shared audience. And you can look to the airline industry for a great example of this. So I live in Boston. Major carrier based out of here is JetBlue, but also if you want a cross-country flight, maybe to San Francisco or LA, there's JetBlue. I think you can actually do Southwest for a while, Virgin, now Alaskan. So you had several carriers from which to choose that all offered basically the same, it was the same flight for about the same price point. Southwest was a little cheaper, but the experiences were very, very different from the time you started booking and were making choices going through the website to getting on the plane, the in-flight experience, whether you got your baggage at the other end or not, if you checked or not. Those experiences were all very different. Both the designed experience, the explicitly designed experience from the color scheme, the in-cabin lighting, all of the climate experience, to the maybe less consciously designed experience that you could say is, well, that's still designed around customer service and how supported someone felt through the experience. Those things were all very different. And they should be, because even though you can buy the same, what is essentially the same product from all three carriers, you're getting a very different experience. And maybe as you look at that target audience, it too varies a little bit. Because if you think of yourself as a JetBlue customer, maybe you've got your credit card through them as well and all, that's where you get your frequent flyer miles, you're probably not going to be looking at those other airlines. Or if you want to just optimize on price, maybe you don't look at JetBlue and Alaskan, you just look at Southwest. So there are ways to differentiate the experience, even in something that is ostensibly a commodity. And brands should. They shouldn't be doing things that are inappropriate to their look and feel, their tone of voice, the overall experience they want to create. Because when they stop differentiating, they're kind of taking that away from the audience. They're taking away another tool that people use to make decisions when they're deciding among them. And I think in not differentiating and in just kind of losing themselves to their users' needs, not serving them, not serving their audience. So I think that it is incredibly important.
I think, as you said, you've been in this industry for a while. I'm seeing, believe it or not. And I'm seeing a lot of folks, newer designers in the field, not have the same exposure to information architecture that I had when I was just starting out. Sapient was sort of a hotbed for a lot of IA thinking back in those days as well. And so one of the things that I'm thinking about is, how do we coach designers newer to the field? How do we help students embrace and understand the kinds of mindsets that we're talking about? What kind of advice do you have for designers newer to the field to maybe not just focus on, you know, what goes on the screen or what the elements are on the screen, and more some of the underlying things that we're talking about? And maybe you can frame that specifically in terms of this lens. If I were a new designer and I needed to apply this lens to my work, what advice would you have for me?
I think to think in terms of accountability, what we owe our audiences and the brands that we support, what those brands owe their audiences. I think to kind of see that at play offline, go to a museum. I still learn a lot by going to museums and really paying attention to exhibit design, how good exhibit designers attend to every aspect of the user's needs, every aspect of the audience's needs, because they have to take into account so many of the things, so many of the responsibilities to which we are also accountable. In other words, when they're putting together a new exhibit, they have to first determine, like, what is the perspective they're bringing to it? how are they going to create new knowledge and help the audience that is coming to that exhibit walk away with something new that maybe they didn't know before? And they also have to take into account that they may have a very broad audience, not to say that like everybody's in their target audience, because we certainly wouldn't want to say that. But they need to take into account the needs of museum patrons, maybe that are there every week or are frequent supporters of the museum or who may already know a lot about that particular topic, as well as maybe school groups or people that are just looking to get out of the rain and into air conditioning. They're serving a pretty broad audience there. But there's still always that mindset of, well, what are we trying to communicate? What are our communication goals? Okay, now once we narrow the playing field to say, maybe if it's an exhibit about the life of a particular artist or a particular artist's commentary on a single topic, if we say, all right, we're just going to take into account what one particular artist wants to say on a topic. Now they're already narrowing that playing field. Maybe they say, well, you know what, we're not going to look at what they said over the course of their entire life, but just through their interactions with their contemporary artists. And they're narrowing the playing field still further. And then they need to address, well, what is feasible? What is kind of feasible and sustainable for our brand, for our museum? And that's a question that every designer, every IA also needs to ask, every content strategist needs to ask. When we're prescribing new content types or trying to decide, well, should we really have a blog on this site? Should it be a video blog? Are we going to have like interviews with maybe our clients or other folks from our target audience? We have to ask, well, what can we sustainably do? Or is this going to be yet another blog that launches with high goals, a great editorial calendar for the first 6 months? And then after that time, we see digital tumbleweeds blowing through. And I think exhibit designers need to think that way as well. What is going to be sustainable? Like they make the list of maybe artwork that they want to bring in from both the permanent collection and then from maybe around the country or around the world, but not everything on their wish list can make it. And if it can't, will that break the overall communication of the exhibit? Then they're also thinking in terms of how do we order this exhibit appropriately so that we're bringing people through from maybe eye-catching pieces or things with which they're already familiar to then build on that to say, well, if you believe this about the topic, wait till you see this other work that the artist created later in her life, building on those same themes. Look at how she further played with them, because that's how they start to build in a very plausible way, new knowledge, new passion for the subject, new understanding around the subject. And that idea of order and process is also what we need to consider when we're trying to create an experience that isn't just pleasant and resonant to our audiences, but also helps them take in new information, paying attention to that sense of discovery, maybe building memory, building that sense of wonder. And that idea of order and process is, I think, from an information architecture perspective, how we are accountable to our audiences without either overwhelming them or demanding too much knowledge upfront. We're not bombarding them with jargon, nor are we dumbing things down for them in the best experiences. Instead, we're teaching them along the way so they're a little smarter and a little bit more confident in their own knowledge by the end. So that's what I would say to somebody new starting out in this profession. Learn all you can on as many projects as you can. I think the best place to do that is at an agency that is taking on a lot of diverse work. Mm. But then step away from that work and go to a museum as well.
And we will leave it there. Margot, thank you so much for your time. That was great advice. And this was a great conversation. So I really appreciate you doing it.
Thank you.